Okay, let's start the show.
For Thursday, June 27th, 2018, 2019. Oh my goodness. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of tested.com. Hello and welcome to a special edition of This Is Only a Test special for a couple of reasons. One, we are a little bit crammed on time today, so we are at a deadline. So it will not be a two-hour-long episode, but we're gonna pack it because there's tons of stuff to talk about. I'm Norm, of course, and joining me to my left is our second foremost Bitcoin expert, Jeremy Williams.
Hi, Norm.
Jeremy, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you. I feel like I've caught up with you in the continuum because now I, too, have seen Toy Story 3.
Four.
It's 2018, right?
That's right. Bitcoin is at an all-time low of $3,000. Well, before we get to Toy Story 4, I want to introduce our very special guest. Not a frequent... Have you been on this podcast before?
I think once. Maybe once.
You're not allowed to speak until I introduce you, by the way.
Jesus.
But our foremost crypto and Bitcoin expert... Gunther Kirsch, producer Gunther Kirsch. How you doing, Gunther?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's amazing to have you here. We're going to get right into it. You know what? No. I'm going to make you sit for a little longer. Ooh. Gunther's only here to talk about our top story this week, but we're not going to do that just yet because I do want to talk about Toy Story 4.
Have you seen it?
I haven't.
Okay.
Well, we're not going to go into full spoilers.
Nope. Yeah.
Because I know probably a lot of you out there, you know, it only made $120 million, which is a lot. It's like a second or third biggest animated film opening after Finding Dory, Incredibles 2, of course, but did not hit the expectations of $130, $150 million. A lot of box office watchers had hoped for Toy Story 4. Now, what did you think about the movie critically?
In the middle of the... I saw it with my whole family, obviously. We all went, my 9-year-old, my 12-year-old, my wife and I. And I didn't buy in throughout the movie.
That sigh.
But I found myself thinking about it, you know,
afterwards. Yeah.
And I realized, okay, no, I actually think I did like this movie. You know, I went to Target and I went to a mall and I saw the toys and I was like, oh yeah, look, it's Keanu Reeves.
he's so good. There are a bunch of new characters, but two of the standout characters is Duke Kaboom, which is Keanu Reeves. He's the Canadian stunt toy. He steals almost every scene he's in. And then also Tony Hale, who plays Forky, the existential toy.
Buster from Arrested Development.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't know that's who it was until after the movie.
From Veep. I mean, I listened to an interview with the director, Josh Cooley, who from last week's episode, if you listen, I was thinking of the right person. Josh Cooley has a book, a children's book, in the model of those golden books.
Yeah.
But based on pop culture movies and like a dark take. So he definitely has a darker comedic sense of humor, and you can see a little bit of that in Toy Story 4. I think maybe their funniest Toy Story movie.
Yeah.
Maybe the funniest Pixar movie.
I don't know about that.
But it's super funny.
Yes.
Definitely
it is super
humor.
Funny.
And
a little bit dark. Is brought by Bunny and Ducky as well.
Oh, Key and Peele.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't think I've heard my wife laugh so much in a film as at those two.
Very explicitly the humor for adults, like it's subversive. A lot of the humor, I mean, they're plushy toys. We're talking about, you know, kidnapping people.
But they're plushy toys who've had a hard life.
Yes. Yeah. And that contrast. Now, so you overall, you liked it. Do you agree with my earlier assessment? Like, didn't feel like it was needed, but by the end, I'm happy it exists. And
sure.
It pulls all the right heartstrings.
I suppose so.
Did you cry at the end?
No. But I didn't cry in Toy Story 3 either.
Oh.
I love Toy Story 1 and 2 so much. Yeah. I think 3 and 4 are fine, but they both feel long shorts. Like I would have been, like they're fine in the universe. I'm happy they exist.
3 wraps things up. 4 wraps things up. But 3 ties a bow on the journey of Andy and Woody and Buzz.
Yep.
And here there are bow tyings at the end as well. Undeniably, the world has changed. It's over.
Trying to avoid some spoilers here.
I'm avoiding spoilers, but they can't go on.
Of course they can. They could always bring it back. Now, I know that they say they're not going to, but they said that after 3.
And Forky will have his own TV show.
That's right, on the on D+.
On Disney+. Sorry. So some of the characters will find extended lives, but the journey that we went along with for the main characters, Tom Hanks.
Yep.
Woody, Tim Allen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's it.
Buzz Lightyear.
I think it's over. Okay. Anyway, that's our spoiler-free recap. You're caught up in the continuum.
Yeah.
Gunther, how was your weekend? We typically start these podcasts off asking people how their weekend was.
Yeah, weekend was good.
There's no time for this.
There's no time for that.
Top story this week.
Well done, Jeremy. If you weren't going to cut him off, I was going to cut him off. Because no, I don't care what you were doing this weekend. I know what you were doing. In fact, I know what both of you were probably doing this weekend. You were checking the indexes.
Yeah, staring at Bitcoin charts, probably.
You were, and that is our top story this week. Because we are, despite what you may have heard and what you might think about the show, we are foremost a technology show. And the top technology story, the top story in our world this week is the re-rise. The phoenix that is Bitcoin.
About a year ago, I programmed a new mode for the game frame, which is my pixel display. So that was basically a Bitcoin chart. And you could track any coin or dollar, and every column is a day. And the past 14 days, or 16 days, which shows on my game frame, has just been going up and up and up and up.
Now, is it going from one green pixel to two green pixels to three?
Yeah.
So it's going parabolic.
Exactly.
Full parabolic.
It's all green.
Yeah, the Bitcoin price has been going crazy. A little bit of a redemption, for sure.
Thank you for speaking into the mic.
Oh, sorry about that. I'm new to this.
I don't know if the last time we had you on the show, we introduced you as such, but you are the office's crypto guru.
I'm that guy.
You're that guy.
The Bitcoin guy.
That's right.
In the
John
office
Oliver
for sure.
Had that whole bit segment
that
about
guy.
That guy. You are our Dave or whatever it was. You are Gunther is the guy who comes in. And if we want to get a 20-minute diatribe
or
thesis
hour.
Or hour on the state of crypto, we can get that anytime. So we're going to pull that cord, open that box, and hear about it. So tell us a recap of the last year or so.
Well, December 2017, the price hit $20,000, and it went from 15 to 20 in 4 days. Or was it 10 to 20 in 4 days?
I feel like it was fast.
It was really fast.
And it was in all the news.
Yeah, it was everywhere. It was on CNBC, Squawk Box, all the mainstream news networks too. So everyone and their mother and father and cousin was buying Bitcoin.
Because it was for the first time quite easy to buy Bitcoin online.
Yeah, there were a lot of very convenient Venmo-like products out there where you can easily buy Bitcoin. I think Cash App was out at that point too, Coinbase. Gemini Exchange, there's quite a few.
And it was far from the Bitcoin ATM experience that Will and I had way back in 2013.
And in the previous bubble, luckily I didn't buy. It wouldn't really have mattered in retrospect because the bubble before this only hit $1,200. But in order to buy Bitcoin around then, you had to sign up for a very sketchy money transfer business called Dwolla. And Dwolla, or Dwolla, would then send that money to... what's the name of the exchange? The big exchange that crashed, Mt. Gox. Okay, so you're trusting this third party, Magic the Gathering Online. It used to be a trading card. Yeah, long history there. So you had to go through these steps to get it on there, and then of course Mt. Gox was hacked. That added to the collapse of the previous bubble. Luckily I didn't get in then. I kind of got in after that around the same time you did, and you bought your Bitcoin in Austin.
Ooh,
at an ATM.
Well done. Well
done. $400.
$400, and I put in, I think, $400 around then, bought one, and then continually just bought a little bit here and there, like, once a month, once a week, whatever it was at the time I set up automatic.
So you are a true believer. You are a guy who hodls.
Definitely.
Who holds.
Yeah, I got into Bitcoin because of the philosophical reasons for it and why I think it's like an innovative, important technology, and somehow managed to not buy any for a few years, surprisingly, probably because coworkers were just telling me not to at the time, which in retrospect was a good thing. Definitely a true believer in it for the long run.
Unregulated, distributed currency that's not based on any type of
government
just saying it has value.
Yeah. And I mean, the history of money is a long one, right? And I think the closest parallel to Bitcoin is gold, which, you know, that invented as a money, who knows, maybe 4,000, 5,000 years ago, something like that. And Bitcoin holds a lot of similar properties to that. And I think that's going to kind of, you know, and gold wasn't decided by any government per se. Maybe different communities, kind of rough governments at the time, decided that it was the best option as a currency. But that emerged because of its actual properties, right? Like gold doesn't tarnish. It doesn't fall apart easily. It doesn't rust or anything like that. It's very divisible. You can have a very tiny chunk of gold.
But it's also finite.
It's also finite. You can't magically make it out of thin air as much as any alchemist tried.
You can only mine it.
You can only mine it. And that's where that parallel comes from. Exactly.
So many parallels.
A lot of parallels. And that has to do not with what it actually physically is, but what the technology itself is. You know, money is a technology. We didn't have money. We didn't have gold money forever, right?
It's a system of trust.
It's a system.
It's a handshake.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a mutual, it's a ledger in and of itself. Like the price of gold is somewhat of a ledger. You know, before we were using shells, and in other cultures, beads.
Three shells, guys.
Yeah, exactly. So Bitcoin is just an improvement on the technology of money itself, and we're in that new phase now.
Okay, so because if, as we're recording this podcast right now, Bitcoin has a value of $13,850.
Wow. It might hit 14 during this podcast.
Up 44% this week.
This week. It was under 10,000 last week. So undoubtedly, a lot of mainstream media, a lot of tech media is going to be
guaranteed.
I mean, we're talking
case
about it
point.
Now.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to be talking about why this is happening. And everyone's going to be trying to forecast, you know, when there are bull markets, like you said, everyone's a genius. What's going to happen next? I don't care about what's going to happen next. You can't predict the future. Why is this happening now?
Oh, man.
Yeah, Gunther.
I try to shy away from price predictions and things like that. Bitcoin has a cycle to it, you know, bull runs and bear markets. And if you go back in the past of Bitcoin and you kind of scroll down the timeline of the price chart, it all looks the same. It's just kind of like a heartbeat on a EKG, and it just repeats itself over and over again, but the price gets bigger each time.
But what causes these spikes to happen? I mean, it was at $4,000 for months and months and months.
Well, I mean, it's people. I think it's a combination of there's a more limited supply. There's been a lot of speculation and news in the media of institutional investors getting into the market and buying at those low prices that we saw from $3,000 to $6,000.
By institutional investors, you mean traditional big banks and finance companies?
Yeah, endowments and managers of large accounts of money. Traditional finance for the most part, not retail investors like Jeremy and I.
Retail investors mean consumers, mom and pops.
Exactly.
People who got screwed over last time.
There's been a lot of speculation that they're finally moving into the market. I mean, you see JPM has their own type of coin coming out. Facebook has Libra coin coming out. Traditional finance is kind of finally acknowledging that, yeah, maybe this crypto market is a thing we should pay attention
to. So regardless, even though Facebook, a multi-billion-dollar company, has announced plans to launch their own crypto for use of their services or however they plan to deploy that, it's not like people are pulling their money out of Bitcoin to then invest in that. It then strengthens further institutional trust in the whole idea of crypto?
I think so. And I think it will also allow more customers, more retail customers, probably to enter the crypto market in general. There'll be another, you know, tradable asset there, Libra to Bitcoin price,
so
presumably.
As the ways to tie your bank account and turn cold hard cash and gold into some type of crypto, they just want ways in.
The more doors in, higher the price will eventually go, presumably.
Because then it's easy to find ways to exchange between different currencies.
Yeah, easier to buy.
It seems to me, like the little I know about institutional investing, it seems to me that institutional investors would never take such a long shot as Bitcoin if by your own admission, it has followed this pattern before. Mm-hmm. It was at $20,000, mm-hmm. and then it was down to $4,000.
Well, very volatile assets provide potentially very high profit ratios.
Right.
So if you can time it right, it's a damn good thing to get in on.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that maybe an institutional investor, someone who's running the finances or the funds for a, you know, $100 million account,
Yale's pension fund, asset manager for Yale's endowment at some point got into crypto over the last bear market. Okay,
is that right?
And that's like, yeah, that's like $800 million, I think, $600 million.
So but for them, they're not putting all of that.
No, 1 to 5% of that is probably all they're putting.
Which is maybe
10. I don't know.
Based on that, that's
millions and millions of dollars.
It's a lot of money, but for them, proportionally, it is
not a very big risk.
Acceptable risk.
Yeah, exactly. And we were talking about this earlier. I think a lot of asset managers are starting to see. If you look at Bitcoin over the last 10 years, the return on investment for that is just insane compared to every other asset out there, every other market out there. The, even though in 2017 we saw a massive bear market, all right, 2 years before that, you're still up on money. So it's an asset manager's job to make money for whatever endowment, whatever fund they're working for. And if it's their fiduciary duty to do that, and they see the rest of the market, they see this like little golden asset over there making a ton of money for a bunch of people, and they don't put 1% in, like 5% in, they're not doing their job. And 1 to 5% is a tolerable risk, as you put it.
So the people who, let's say the needle is really moved by big investors, big financial, because they're the ones who have
whales.
Access to have hundreds of million dollars. It's not the mom and pops, even though that's what gets the mainstream awareness. It's really, it's the big investors. Is the thought that, okay, it previously hit this crazy high of 20,000. Now that we're 2 years after that, year and a half after that, they think that it can go past that, or do they think it's going to hit that again? And that's like a psychological, like, is there a limit at that point? Then it just plummets again.
This is not investing advice, people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Here's a disclaimer. We do not provide investment advice on this podcast. This is purely for amusement only.
Because I know whatever Gunther's about to say, if he's going to go long-term enough, it's going to sound really, really interesting.
Hey, Gunther, the Kool-Aid you're serving is intoxicating, it's still Kool-Aid nonetheless.
You know, it's a fine line between cult and community, and the Bitcoin community definitely blurs that at times.
So those people do believe that it has the potential to...
Yeah, I mean,
much higher.
It's the whole thing with Bitcoin is it's a scarce digital asset. It's scarce. And if something's scarce and the demand for it keeps going up, eventually the price will keep going. How it gets there, who knows?
Supply and demand.
When it gets there, who knows?
We were just having lunch before the podcast and I asked, hey, isn't there something happening next year with Bitcoin? And both of you, Jeremy and Gunther, simultaneously, at the same time, said,
the halving.
And the way you said it was so cult-like. you guys made eye contact.
We did.
And said, the halving.
The difference is he knows what it means and I don't.
The halvening.
In the Bitcoin code, it's programmed that the mining reward for mining new blocks decreases at a set amount. It halves. Okay, and that's happening next year. So miners will receive less, half as much Bitcoin for every block
for
they
how
mine.
Much work they put in, how much GPU time mm-hmm. they put in.
Yeah, you'll recall that there was a GPU shortage a year ago, because people were buying them all up so that they could mine Bitcoin.
Right.
And
actually mostly altcoins probably, and then exchanging that for Bitcoin, but basically same principle.
Right, and so that has recently, since Bitcoin dropped along with every altcoin price, that's become a lot less compelling. And you're saying that a year from now, it's going to become even less compelling?
Even less compelling. I mean, it kind of depends on what the price ratio is at that time, too. Like, say the altcoin market is just 10xing.
Yeah.
There's calculators out there. The amount that your GPU costs, the amount the power costs, and what your return on investment is and when you can plug it in.
Do we get to a place where these miners are it's no longer financially prudent for them to hoard all the GPUs and build up these mining farms? It becomes just more stabilized.
Yeah, I mean,
not a gold rush essentially.
I would think so. I think we're past the gold rush phase of Bitcoin, when everyone was just taking their gaming PC and mining Bitcoin when they weren't playing games on it. The profitability is not there anymore. All Bitcoin mining takes place with ASIC computers that are specifically designed to hash that algorithm constantly.
And isn't that necessary also for transactions? So the mining sort of happens
parallel? Exactly. New coins are created through the formation of blocks, and blocks also contain transactions. And they can only fit, I think, about 2 megabytes worth of transactional data into them. But along with creating that block, you get new Bitcoins, and those new Bitcoins go to the miners who created that new chain of transactions, the blockchain.
When was the last time there was a halving?
I think it was 3 or 4 years ago.
What happened then?
Same thing that'll happen this time. You mean the price? I mean, if you look at the charts, it roughly takes place before a massive bull run. So I think the last halving took place after it surpassed $1,200, but before it was like 2 or 4. So kind of after it had passed the previous all-time highs. So in this case, maybe it'll do the same thing. Maybe Bitcoin price will get above 20,000. We'll have the halving and that'll trigger another bull run. Who knows?
All right.
I mean, we're already in a bull run as it is. Let's be real.
Wow. That's a lot to take in. In the time it took for you to explain that, Bitcoin has dropped $2,000.
It's not true, is it?
No, it's not.
And when everyone hears this, it'll be back to 8K.
Right.
All right. Well, we'll have to have you back, Gunther, at the next big...
The happening.
The next big inflection point or parabola moment, whatever your terminology is, for crypto. But the past 15 minutes... It's all for you, Norm's Bitcoin.
I miss you. I miss you so much. Do we need a theme song for the crypto minute?
Yeah.
The mining
minute?
We need
a name.
Yeah.
I don't think we can do the mining minute because we already have a moment of science in the VR minute.
Right, yeah.
So we need something more clever.
I mean, the Bitcoin bit or the crypto bit.
That's
too easy.
Let's put it out there for you. All right, if we're not going to do this segment on the reg. You know, who knows? You know, if it skyrockets, maybe we'll have it every other week, or maybe once every 6 months makes more sense. But we'd love your pitch for what a crypto segment could be named. And for those of you out there, I guys know there's some very talented composers out there.
Yep.
If you want to generate a segment intro piece, please submit that. You can email it directly to us.
Special request, if you do make one, please include the BitConnect guy.
You don't know. I don't know if we can use that.
Yes, you can.
That audio bite.
YouTube that if you haven't seen it. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
BitConnect.
Thanks, guys.
Bitcoin.
Thank you, Gunther.
Thank you, Gunther. You can crawl out from under the table here.
Let's go that way.
All right. Now, this is probably would have been the more appropriate time to talk about Toy Story 4. Well, now we can talk about spoilers. No, we won't talk about spoilers. A lot of people haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll wait.
It is a movie that sticks with you.
Yeah.
You know something we didn't talk about? The technical achievement of that film.
Dude, seriously. Like, it is probably the most beautiful Pixar film. And that's saying a lot. And it's from... And not, like, from a color standpoint, necessarily.
Oh, I think, in addition... Yes, from a color standpoint.
But from a cinematography standpoint. From what they're doing, like, with camera simulation. You know, remember the Piper film?
Yeah.
The little bird on the beach?
Yes,
and
yes.
All that shallow focus stuff that they did, which was incredible.
With the virtual lenses.
Yeah. And this... Toy Story 4 is loaded with that.
I think they definitely had that for a couple reasons. One, when you get that tight and that shallow... depth of field, the stuff behind you, the bloom gets really pretty. And when they had the carnival scenes in Toy Story 4, they did that for a lot of the carnival stuff because, of course, you're looking at macro lenses, right? If you're getting to the table height, the scale of toys, you're using macro lenses and everything in the back, then everything is bloomed out. So when you have these natural lights, something they also talked about is they cheat less now in terms of the lighting. So earlier Pixar films, while you have practical lights, like this room, we have a light here, here, and here that's lighting us, they can put a light anywhere without actually having to illuminate all the characters.
They talked about doing per character light.
Exactly. So for Woody, they would have a light like that would bounce and give you the backlighting, the shadow, and stuff like that. But that virtual light wouldn't necessarily affect someone like Buzz, who has more reflective surfaces in his dome. But as they – maybe it's both an artistic and a technical challenge for them as they have improved their technology – they have lit their scenes for real.
Like the new NVIDIA cards, when we talked about a couple weeks ago where they're running Quake 2 with real-time ray tracing now, those rays that they're tracing are one or two bounces.
Right.
The stuff in Toy Story 4 is 128. I mean, it's just nonstop. And the refractions that you get looking through bent glass surfaces or the light bounces that you see inside the pinball machine, for instance, off of the porcelain Bo Peep. You know,
well, they were saying for Bo Peep especially, like that is a porcelain character, as you said. So the light bounces off her in a very specific way.
Yeah.
And not only the intensity of light, but the shape of light. So in the scenes that Bo Peep's in, they could not use square lights, I believe. They had to use circular lights because otherwise if you use a rectangular light, like an LED panel and bounces up, you would see a rectangular reflection, which would be unflattering. And so those highlights have to be taken into account.
It's amazing, the detail. And not to mention the detail of that pinball machine.
Oh, like, yeah, yeah. So it was, yeah, that, not a spoiler, but there is a pinball machine.
Well,
so,
that's actually in the trailer. Like, you actually see it for a moment in the trailer, both the outside and the inside.
So was that, do you think, a real interior of a pinball machine?
I think that was absolutely modeled off of the interior of a pinball machine. I don't know if it was an exact actual pinball machine.
So you're saying they, because I know the playfield was fake. They made up a game.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Because you don't see the playfield very much at all.
I think I can say that. I know from people I've talked to that they designed a, at least conceptually,
yeah,
a game.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. Which you don't see. But
inside that game are pinball parts, like 100% authentic.
So the question is, though, did they make a playfield where the holes, where the gels,
right,
would be?
Inserts, yeah.
The inserts would actually be where the light would illuminate for the lighting,
right,
of the interior of that
machine.
Well,
who knows? Are you saying, is it modeled off a real game?
No. I'm saying, did they design it so like...
So like it could be.
It could be, yeah.
Yes, and that's absolutely unnecessary because nobody's going to actually care if the wires and the parts,
right,
look authentic.
Except you.
Right, and pinball heads. And yeah. So that's cool. I don't know if they have... They must have... looked inside a pinball machine. I don't know if it was at Pixar, if they went somewhere and did research, but
I mean, they're in the East Bay. They could have just went to the Pacific Pinball Museum.
I was highly impressed.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you like the antique store? How complex that was. Did you appreciate the complexity of the antique store?
Well, there's so much going on there. Did you notice some of the Easter eggs in there?
No.
There's a... I don't know. Do you want to go into it? there are...
Characters?
No. There's Pixar shorts.
Oh, I mean, Tin Toy, I saw.
Well, he's there. He's in the pinball machine, but there are actual film reels that you can
see
of some of the Pixar shorts. Yeah,
well, that's great.
It's great.
I was hearing about how that antique store as interior space is the most complex interior space they've ever made.
Interesting.
As an environment. Just because, like, if you think about Andy's room or even the nursery, the daycare, Toy Story 3, that's a lot of stuff there, but that's not nearly as complex as just, they took, like, a volume, they built out every single item.
There's not many spaces more complex than an antique store.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff.
And the simulation they do for the dust bunnies and the webbing, like, to actually age it over time, like, that was all super, super cool.
Yeah, and the cat... Very realistic.
I think a lot of people have pointed that out, compared with the dog from Toy Story 1,
right,
to the cat, and a lot of it with the lighting. They were very bold with a lot of high-key lighting.
Yeah.
Like cat going into the sunlight, and the blue, like
again,
the HDR.
Cinematography, incredible. But how do you feel about Pixar inching into realism? Like, I've felt like there's always been elements of their films that have looked realistic, but they've been juxtaposed against a cartoonish world. And I wonder, like, obviously they have the power now, as CG across Hollywood can show, to do realism. And I wonder, like, is that a line that they're very careful to cross?
I think they are very careful. Because the line is right there in the film. And the humans in the film are still not based on, there's real people, right? They're cartoon interpretations.
Yeah.
They are the 3D versions of a sketch drawing. But the cat is very close to a real cat, at least the fur. Now, I'm sure the cat was also...
The stretching, the movement.
Yeah, exactly. So, where is that line? I don't think they're going to ever do, like, a true photoreal Robert Zemeckis-type movie.
Well, God, like, that wasn't photoreal, but
the intention, right?
Yeah,
the intention,
yeah.
I don't think they're ever going to do that. I think their roots are still in traditional animation and giving artists a chance
cartoons
to interpret, exactly, character design characters.
Yeah.
And the toys are the closest thing, right? The toys are based on real toys. And and even like Bo Peep went actually away from being, they moved away. Like Bo Peep and Woody are less like the kind of toys you'd find in stores and more like cartoons now, even though the characters that surround them, Mr. Potato Head, Rex, not even Buzz Lightyear, but like, the other toys, like the army men, are based off the real toys. Like Bo Peep looks more like a cartoon than a porcelain doll now that you find in a store.
Yeah.
Proportionally and aesthetically. I think it's a great film. I want to see it again.
Yeah, me too.
And I think if you look at Onward, like we talked about last week, their next film, again, not super hyper-realistic in terms of the character design. It's going to be, again, cartoonish characters, orcs in that case. Okay, moving on. Other pop culture news. Next weekend... Or next week, next Thursday, is July 4th.
That's right.
And not only are we going to celebrate America's independence, we're also going to celebrate the release of Stranger Things season 3.
That's right. Yeah.
The final trailer, I guess there have been a couple teasers and a trailer. The final trailer is out. I have not watched this yet. Is something I should watch or
I would actually hold off on it then because it actually gives you a little bit of story that you don't know yet.
Oh.
Yeah, but so if you haven't seen it and you don't want to talk about it, then we'll avoid talking about this. But it is an event. I'm excited for it. They spent a lot of extra time and money apparently on this season, delaying it for a bit, and I'm excited to see how it ends up. I'm loving this series, and I'm so glad that I think my 12-year-old is now old enough to join me in the Stranger Things phenomenon.
Has he seen the first 2 seasons?
No.
So you have a lot of work to do.
Yeah. I think we'll probably start watching this year.
Wow. Do you need season 2, really?
Right. Even the Lego set is only from season 1.
Yeah, I don't think you really... Season 1 is kind of all you need. You can kind of fill in some of the characters.
You might be right about that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously season 3 has all the characters introduced in season 2, but... And season 2 does have a couple really good scenes.
Yes. Also coming out next weekend is Spider-Man Far From Home. This is the final film in Phase 3. It's kind of the epilogue film.
That comes out the weekend of July, after July 4th?
No, it is. It comes out July 2nd.
Oh, wow.
It comes out the Tuesday.
Tuesday, okay.
And while reviews have not been out yet, they're not, like, there is no Rotten Tomatoes score yet, you had the first, the social reviews. This is, again, what marketing departments do these days. People who've gone to see it, they have an embargo for putting their impressions online in 280 characters, and there's also an embargo for putting an actual score on it, you know, kind of like what we had for the Valve Index.
Yep.
We put out our impressions, but not put a stamp of approval. That comes when the product is released. So the initial impressions are that it's great. I think that's all we need to really hear. People are happy with it.
Yep.
Apparently the villain, or the quote unquote who we think is the villain, Mysterio, is supposed to be really good. A lot of people have said there are lots of shocking twists and turns, and I think. I'm very excited for that.
This is I know it's not an MCU film, but it's the first Marvel film post Endgame.
It is an MCU film.
It is now?
Why? Spider-Man Homecoming was an MCU film.
I can't follow this stuff.
So I'm going to go into pure speculation territory because I have not seen this. I've only seen the trailers. And you're right. The reason it's confusing is because this is a Sony-owned character for the filmmaking rights. Spider-Man is a Marvel character, and it all came out during the Sony hack. Right, remember the big North Korean Sony hack?
Right.
There was a handshake agreement between Sony and Disney that while Sony still had all the movie-making rights to Spider-Man, and they reaped the profits, they would allow Spider-Man to be in the MCU. And for trade, the Marvel Studios would produce the Spider-Man films.
Ah, okay.
So it is a Kevin Feige joint. His direction, his overarching plan. That's why Tony Stark was in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah.
He was the big trade, right?
Yeah, I thought it was a trade. But
going forward, it's still an MCU film.
Got it.
So the ramifications of Endgame are dealt with in this film. That's why Sam Jackson.
That's why I'm interested in seeing this.
That's why a lot of people.
As much for the Spider-Man, you know, hoopla that is going to happen and all the amazing effects and whatever story they have to tell, what I want to see is, what is the world post-Endgame?
It's the halo effect. It's the same. It's not the only reason. I want to make it clear. But it's one of the reasons that people were very interested in seeing Captain Marvel as well.
Yeah.
Is because it was the movie that was sandwiched between Infinity War and Endgame. And so you have this nice halo effect of the Phase 3 finale of Endgame. And this being the first epilogue story, I think, is a big deal. But I think it's going to stand on its own. My big theory, because this is the confusing thing, Sony, while has handed over the production responsibilities of Spider-Man to the Marvel Studios, to MCU, they still hold on tight their own production on things like Into the Spider-Verse, the other Spider-Man stories, right? Miles Morales, and also Venom. Venom was not MCU at all and didn't even mention Spider-Man. But at some point, and Kevin Feige has admitted, like, Venom will probably, like, they will probably have to reconcile that at some point. How? Well, as you saw in Into the Spider-Verse, there is a multiverse.
I did see that.
And of different spider people. And so maybe the story of Venom, which at the very end was set up for a sequel, maybe that's a Venom that does not belong in the MCU, but is a different Earth and has a different Spider-Man, and which of course is, would be the case with the Miles Morales Spider-Man, same with the Chris Pine Spider-Man, same with the what's his name from New Girl Spider-Man, older Spider-Man.
And Kevin Feige, he's in it for the long run. He's like the Russo brothers are hanging their hats. They're done with,
for now.
With the MCU for
probably
now.
For now.
But Feige is 100% still involved.
It's his baby.
Phase 4 and beyond.
Yes.
Okay.
But yes, but at the same time, they will be very cautious to say that they take one movie at a time.
Yeah.
Like they while there are loose plans, it's not like all the machinations are already turning. Like they want to make their one good movie now.
Yeah.
Then move on to the next good movie, one phase at a time.
I'm stunned that that's the case, because the quality, the consistency that they have managed to,
that's the miracle,
to foster is incredible.
Yeah, I was listening to Kevin Smith do an interview, because he's making Jay and Silent Bob return, a reboot, right? And he was talking about his appreciation for the MCU films is that he got to enjoy the characters as a kid, but a lot of times as an adult, you don't have that same type of wonder. You're a little bit jaded, like Star Wars, perfect example. The way you enjoy Star Wars, the original trilogy, was probably different than the way you enjoyed the prequel trilogy, even though there's a whole generation of kids, I mean, that's to say it lightly, but there's a whole generation of kids who enjoy the prequel trilogy as much as you enjoy the original trilogy. It struck the same chord, the same magic, the same amount of fun.
Uh-huh.
I don't necessarily associate with that generation, but, you know, Gunther loved the prequel trilogy, his generation, right? Mm-hmm. Those are the characters they grew up with, right? The clones and all the Clone Wars stuff and the Rebels, right? All that stuff.
Roger.
And with the MCU, it feels like we got the double dip. We got to enjoy them as adults as much as the kids got to enjoy them. And the sense of wonder that we felt reading these characters, and this goes to people who read the characters, read Captain America, read
Iron
Man.
You're talking about as a kid as reading the comic books.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
On film, I got to enjoy.
I thought you meant because the MCU's been going so long. Like you
were 10 years ago.
Like you were a kid.
That's only 10 years.
10 years, like when it started. Yeah, but you could imagine that happening.
And a lot of people who are just watching these films, 13-year-olds,
yeah,
they were three when Iron Man came
out. They didn't see Iron Man when it came out.
They probably grew up with Phase 3, right? They grew up watching Guardians. Guardians was their entry. Guardians 2, maybe, was their entry point into the MCU. Yeah, so hopefully they can hold on and do this. I don't think there'll be another Endgame, like, moment.
But you will be seeing Endgame again.
But there will be another Endgame release. That's this weekend, the 28th. We talked about this last week. This is Kishore going to the movie a dozen times more. That's where he's right now. Kishore isn't on the podcast. It's because he's in line to watch Endgame to bolster its final tally. I think right now, what did we say, 45 million below Avatar last weekend? I think it's like 30-something now.
It's creeping.
But the re-release, and they have confirmed that it's going to be a new intro from the directors.
Oh, interesting.
It's going to be a deleted scene at the end of the film, and it's going to be an extended look.
A deleted scene, not an outtake. A deleted scene.
A deleted scene.
Interesting.
I think the caveat would say it does not have final effects, so it will basically look like a DVD extra.
Okay.
A digital extra.
And what was the third thing?
The third thing is a Spider-Man Far From Home extended look.
Oh.
So an extended trailer.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's going to temper people's... I think like the AMC theaters and all the other cinemas are making a big deal about this re-release. People can buy tickets now. So I'm going to go this weekend. It's probably last chance for a long time to see Endgame in theaters. So
when we went to see Toy Story 4, we saw a bunch of trailers. One of them was for Trolls World Tour.
Oh, boy.
Now, I'm telling you, if you have a approximately 10-year-old girl... She's psyched.
This is her endgame. This is her endgame.
Yes, I have one of those, and she's psyched. Trolls is previously, I think, her favorite film. Listens to the soundtrack nonstop, and this looks good. They've broken music into its basic genres, and there's trolls for every one of them, and there's different lands. So it looks cool.
All right, that's the report from the animation world. I've got some J.J. Abrams news. J.J. Abrams, of course, he is working hard on Episode 9, that's coming out this
Christmas
December.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Why is that crazy?
I mean, it feels very soon.
Soon from Solo or soon from Episode 7?
No, soon from now.
Oh, yes.
It feels like it's like right over the hill. Like, it's not next year.
Really?
It is. We're in the second half of the year already.
I know.
Right? It's this half of the year.
Yeah.
it'll be the end of the saga.
Okay. I think you have more strong feelings about this than I do.
I
don't know.
Your expectations are properly tempered.
At this point, I could not see it and be happy. Yes, I said it.
Wow.
I said it.
You know, if you say it, then why don't you just don't see it, Jim?
Do you know what I...
Don't see it. Go watch Trolls 2. Don't watch Episode 9. That's okay.
You know what I'd like more than anything, though, is to hear that it's great. And then I'll go see it. And that'll be great.
No, why don't you not hear that it's great, watch it, and then realize that it is great. I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be great, but I don't need to hear that it's great to be excited to see it. I'm going to go in and then hope that it's great. And if it is, I'll be very happy.
Mm-hmm.
Don't watch any more trailers. Go with an open mind.
All right.
If you're disappointed, you're disappointed.
Yep.
That's okay. There's plenty of J.J. Abrams to go around. There was a big tease online this past week, Spider-Man related. Marvel Comics put out an image in Spiderwebs, the number 4. And people went crazy thinking that this was a return to the Sam Raimi-verse. Get this.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about generational differences. Yeah. There are a bunch of people who are still true believers of the Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire take on Spider-Man.
You're talking about the first run of Spider-Man that we had.
The first run.
15 years ago.
Yes. The started in, I believe, 98 and then ended in 06 or so.
Oh, wow.
But those films obviously were the the first film to break $100 million and really, along with X-Men, started the modern superhero craze.
Upside Down Kiss.
Yep. Riffed on into the Spider-Verse. But we saw that, we remember with the release of the Spider-Man game, the PS4 game, even then, fans of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man were clamoring for a Sam Raimi Spider-Man skin.
Really?
And Insomniac delivered. I mean, they've been working on it for a long time.
Yeah.
They released that skin. So there were fans of that out there.
Mm-hmm.
So they were hoping that this was like, okay, is this that version of Spider-Man going to continue in the comics? No. It was a 4-3-2 was an announcement, and it is J.J. Abrams with his son, I believe, writing a Spider-Man comic.
Okay. Well, when you're J.J. Abrams, you get to do what you want.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
This is the art is Sarah Pichelli, who did Ultimate Spider-Man, so it's going to be great art. The covers are by Olivier Coipel, who does amazing art. 5-part miniseries, no word on what the actual story is, but the promise from J.J. Abrams is that it will show Peter Parker in a way you haven't seen before. He's going to be a secret agent, then revealed to be a Kryptonian.
That's a joke.
That's an in-joke, because J.J. Abrams wrote a script for the McGee Superman film before even the Bryan Singer Superman film. And in it, his big twist was Lex Luthor was not a corporate billionaire industrialist. Uh-huh. Lex Luthor was a secret agent and then also ended up being...
From Krypton?
From Krypton.
That's crazy.
Crazy bad. J.J. Abrams, last bit of J.J. Abrams pop culture news. This was a kind of an insider thing, but apparently there was a bidding war for J.J. Abrams. The J.J. Abrams bidding war for his production company, Bad Robot, in terms of a partnership. So studios vie for partnerships. Distribution networks vie for partnerships with production companies to have a first rights for their ideas for TV shows, for movies, for all sorts of media. And apparently for Bad Robot, everyone wanted to work with J.J. Abrams. You know, Disney wanted to work with J.J. Abrams.
Who wouldn't?
Apple wanted. Apple was a strong contender to work with J.J. And Apple is, I think.
Didn't they get him on their network?
For something.
Yeah.
But this is going forward, and it turns out that Warner Brothers, Warner Media, AT&T, is in the final negotiations for the partnership with Bad Robot to the tune of $500 million. They're going to invest $500 million into producing content to come out of Bad Robot.
That's crazy, man.
That is crazy. Yeah. I mean, it happens all the time. Like, TV creators, there's a ton of money out there.
Yeah.
And creators, ideas and execution are in high demand. And so you have like Shonda Rhimes, you know, from all the ABC shows doing a $100 million deal with Netflix. You have, what does this guy do? Ryan Murphy, who I believe did the American Horror Stories. No, Glee stuff. Big $300 million deal, J.J. Abrams. $500 million deal with Warner Media, which could mean HBO content, because that's all under Warner Media today.
Oh, yeah?
HBO shows. Or it could mean...
What?
J.J. Abrams directed DC Batman. Universe movie.
Yeah.
Going back to Superman. Yeah. Here, there goes your Lex Luthor secret agent story.
Hey, you might be right about
taking
that.
Taking it out of the cupboard, out of the closet.
Why not?
And I don't think so.
Why not? He didn't do any Marvel stuff, right?
He didn't do any Marvel. That's true. Yeah. He just did Star Wars. Yeah, if J.J. Abrams was going to do a DC film, I would want him to do Green Lantern.
Okay. Let's move on.
That does it for pop culture news. Kishore's not here, so I don't have anyone to riff with. And we're going to, before we continue to our next segment, I want to thank one of the sponsors that makes this episode possible, and that is SiriusXM. If you don't know SiriusXM, then listen up. SiriusXM brings you the deepest variety of commercial-free music for every genre and for every mood. Where you hear the biggest names in talk, entertainment, and comedy, where you get news from every source. And a lot of people think that you need a car to enjoy SiriusXM, but you don't. You can listen outside of the car. And right now, you can get your first 3 months of SiriusXM outside the car for just $1. Go to SiriusXM.com/test to see the offer details and to subscribe. And for $1, you can listen to SiriusXM on your phone, at home, and online. So anywhere you are, any time of day, you can hear your favorite songs or discover new ones. Go to Sirius, that's SiriusXM.com/test and get your first 3 months of SiriusXM outside the car for $1. See offer details. Offer available to new SiriusXM streaming subscribers. SiriusXM, no car required.
Did you see the shirt I'm wearing, by the way? Got this at a Disney store.
It's a Punisher shirt.
This is a Sid Phillips shirt.
Oh, that's right.
Isn't this great?
Yeah.
And it glows in the dark, dude.
Did his shirt glow in the dark?
Yeah.
Really?
Pretty sure. Pretty sure.
From Toy Story 1.
Or 2, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure it glows in the dark.
He wasn't in Toy Story 2.
Yeah, he was at the end.
Yeah.
So it must have been Toy Story.
And he's in Toy Story 3. He's the garbage guy.
Oh, then that's what I was thinking.
He's the garbage truck.
Are you right? Is he not in Toy Story 2?
I don't think he's in Toy
Story. Must have been Toy Story 1. I'll have to go back and watch that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it glows in the dark. That's the point.
Huh.
Really bright.
That's your cosplay for next
I'm thinking
next
it might be my Halloween costume. Hey, what kind of pie do you like?
I like, you know, honestly, my favorite type of pie is a mixed berry pie.
Ooh. Do you like pie that includes raspberries?
As long as there are blueberries and strawberries as well, yes.
Because the Raspberry Pi 4 has been announced, ladies and gentlemen.
Ooh, big deal.
It's a big deal for people who dig on little mini computers. Same price point.
$35.
$35 gets you a mini PC. And that mini PC is now a lot more powerful. It's got, it's like they went all in on I.O. So same number of USB jacks, but now two of them are USB 3.
And it charges over USB Type-C.
And the port for charging, yes, it's USB Type-C, although that's not used for data, so it really is just a charging thing.
That's interesting.
They also have two HDMI jacks now.
Micro HDMI jacks.
That's the only way they could fit them.
Those are the most expensive adapters.
Well, I mean, come on now. Especially with this now on the market, I'm sure that the adapters are going to be cheap.
I don't know.
You'll probably get cables that are just one on one side and the other on the other, and just use that.
Ugh. I hate micro HDMI.
Do you?
What
do you have that uses it?
I had drones that used it. What did I have? There were a few things that used it. Just always tough to find that adapter.
There were some graphics cards that uses like a middle one. The small but not micro.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was like hard to find. I know, I get it. Like when you want an HDMI signal, you just want to plug an HDMI cable.
Yep.
But here you get two of them, Norman.
And two that run at gives you 4K
each,
output.
4K each, 30 hertz, or a single one at 60, 4K. Wow.
All right.
That's
all
pretty
right.
Great. You got three different memory SKUs, too. You got standard 1 gigabyte, which is the $35 model, and then you have 2 and 4 SKUs above that. They've never done that before.
2 gigabyte. How much is a 4 gigabyte? Oh,
it's
high-end.
$55.
That's not bad at all.
The 2 gigabyte is $45.
Not upgradable.
No. It's all surface mount. It's all on there. It's got a faster processor and also a higher clock speed. Ars Technica is saying that the processor will give you double to quadruple the processing power.
Wait. Even though it's 1.5 gigahertz over 1.4 gigahertz.
Because it's a different processor. I forget. It's like the A75 versus the A57.
It's a Broadcom processor.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It has, faster GPU and real gigabit. The last one had gigabit, but it was forced through a USB 2.0 bus, and so it was super slow.
480 megabytes per second.
Now you get full gigabit speeds, has Bluetooth 5, dual band wireless Wi-Fi, so it supports 5G, and faster micro SD talking.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about all the internal I.O.?
There's some, like, the same GPIOS, GPIO interface pins, but I think there's some new interfaces. Like, there's a new I2C, new UART serial pin. So it just overall looks good. I'll be very curious to see how this memory split affects the ecosystem, because now you're going to need not just a 4, you're going to need to know which SKU. Like, how much memory does the application require? Like, if you're running, like, the new fangled version of MAME on your emulator box, maybe in order to run certain systems, you're going to need the more RAM, and you're not going to have that. So I'm curious to see how that affects things. But overall,
do you feel like they're going to be supply constrained?
They are supply constrained.
Yeah.
I narrowly got one.
Oh, which model?
The 2, the only one that Adafruit stocked for about 5 minutes. I just happened to be on the site. I signed up for notifications. I didn't even get one, but I checked the site, and it was like in a weird state, and I was able to add one to my cart. It's shipped, so it's coming, but I never even got a notification that it was in stock.
Well, I'm going to love the new I.O., the new ports, the updated designs for all your Pi cases. 3D printed, all your laser cut.
It's all got to be new now.
Everyone has going to come up with their new ones. They're going to sell their own, which looks pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to buy it for $5, actually not bad. Not bad at all. But I know a lot of people take pride in designing their cases for their Pis.
Yeah. So there'll be a lot of new designs coming out. It still has that mini jack for headphones, which also has a composite video signal. So if you really need...
I mean,
old school, you can have that.
Raspberry Pi has always been like the default build your own X type processor, but you've moved away from it. You use Particle Photon for most of your stuff now.
Well,
because you don't need
Linux. Yeah. So I like microcontrollers just because I can code in C and it's just, and they boot up instantly.
Right.
And it's just like the things that I need. It's not a whole bunch of subsystems. Yeah. And I can sort of do what I have to do in Linux, but I'm not a super user. So I didn't mean to make a Linux pun there, but it is not a world that I'm comfortable in. So I use microcontrollers where possible, but if you want to make a main box, you're not doing that on a Photon.
Yeah.
You're using a Raspberry Pi or a real computer, but now this will hopefully get you a few new games or whatever. I use it as my OctoPi. I use it to run my 3D printers.
Yeah,
that's great. And maybe this will help it boot up a little bit faster.
This is the Pi 4. So hopefully, the thing that's more shocking isn't what they've crammed into it. It's that they kept it the same price. That's their big philosophy, right? This low cost, this form factor computer.
Yeah.
And so hopefully they can keep it there. And the increase in price for the 2 gigabyte, 4 gigabyte models isn't going to be like the new normal. It's not going to be like base price $50 going forward as they improve functionality.
With the smaller ones, like with the Raspberry Pi Zero, which is a $5 Raspberry Pi, like there's just no margin on that. So you can hardly find them sold by themselves. They always sell them in kits, like with cases and power adapters and SD cards. So that's still possible with this. But it's a little, you can at least find these by themselves.
All right. So that's Raspberry Pi. Good luck in finding one, and we'll love hearing your thoughts once you get yours.
Yeah.
Hey, I got an update.
Yeah.
You know, Gunther was on this podcast, but half an hour ago.
Uh-huh. Oh, Bitcoin's down.
Bitcoin has dropped $2,000. So I was prophetic in
that
remark.
That's great.
Right?
That's great.
Yeah, it's as of right now, it's a plummet, 11,600. So everything we said,
13,200.
No, it's 11,000 right now.
No,
it's 11,600. It's dropped, like I said, $2,000.
That's amazing.
It's a plummet.
Holy cow! Hold the phone. It is. That's impressive.
I'm just using Google. I'm just searching.
He's probably out there crying right now.
Wave of emotions. If only we had started this podcast half hour later.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Well, it's a risk, but buying Bitcoin's a risk. And here's another risk, although a little bit less of a risk. You can also install iOS 13 beta, public beta on your devices now, on your iPhone and your iPad. And I've taken the jump, taken the leap. I iPad OS 13 was the thing I was most curious about coming out of WWDC, and I installed the profile and downloaded it, and I'm running it on the iPad Pro right now.
So in order to install betas previously, you know, years ago, you had to sign up as a developer,
yeah.
and that cost $100. And right. then you had to download the install, and then it was you had to install it through iTunes. Is it super easy as a public beta?
It's super easy. It literally is a website where you type in your Apple ID
mm-hmm.
to add it to the system. Then you click a link on your device to download a profile. And then in settings, it says accept profile, update.
And all your data stays.
Well, that's the thing. If you're going to update to iOS 13 beta, and a lot of people have, please back up your device first because you cannot go back. It's very, very difficult to go back and retain your data. So before, if you're on 12, connect it to iTunes, do a hard backup, encrypt it, whatever you do. I mean, it is a public beta. They're pretty confident in it now. So when you update to this, if you don't run it... You know, cross your fingers, no problems. You can just update to the final one when you're done.
I read that it wasn't a solid beta. I mean, it really is the first public beta of a series.
I mean, it's, from my experience...
It's been fine on the iPad, not on the phone. Yeah. You're using an iPad Pro? Yeah.
iPad Pro.
Okay.
I mean, performance has never been a problem on this device, so I don't notice any performance improvements, but UI, very different on iPad Pro. Of course, there's a ton more app icons on the screen now, up from, I believe, 20 to 30.
Can I see?
The home screen... Yeah, look at that. That's a lot of icons, right? The home screen now, you can pull in that the
sidebar.
The sidebar.
Yeah.
It's their way of doing widgets. Your mileage may vary. I never liked using that home screen. I think the layout of their widgets, even though you can reorder them, it just doesn't provide all the info that I want.
Yeah.
Like what I previously get out of an Android device in terms of getting my mail listing.
Yeah.
Actually, a calendar. It is their version of the calendar, their version of the Photos app. Sure, it's good for battery and weather, but like... I wish it was a little more customizable, but it is different.
What do you like about iPadOS?
So I haven't done the mouse support yet, so I'm curious about that. There are new shortcuts. The big thing is the web browsing. Safari now has the full desktop class web browsing.
Do you notice the difference?
Yes.
Huh.
It is the desktop version for everything.
Okay.
Now, there's also this thing that lets you do a side-by-side.
That's interesting. That's like real multitasking, right?
The execution, I think, is flawed currently.
Okay.
It happens, so if I'm on a website, I'll give you a quick demo here. If I'm on a website, like I'm on Tested right now, I can open a link by holding it and then dragging it off to the side.
Okay. It's kind of an overlay second window.
No, I did it the wrong way. That's one way to do it. Hold on. You can do it the overlay, like there's two forms of multitasking. Yeah. There's the slide in that's one third of the screen.
This is where I think it's bifurcating the user base. Like there will be power users that know all of this.
Oh, that's happening right now.
Yeah, you're probably right.
It's not, and of course, a lot of this also is incorporating the gesture-based stuff that was in the iPhone 10, like the cards.
Uh-huh.
They're using that card model now, so you have the same same bar on the bottom of your little mini windows. So basically, you have like a little iPhone screen
right.
on your screen.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I'm reaching. The beta limits right now, the bugginess. Oh my God, it's bugged.
Well, just paint a word picture. So
the way you do side by side, you hold down a link and you drag it to the left or right side, and that opens a second Safari.
But you have to drag it. Seems like you have to drag it pretty far.
You drag it pretty far, okay. And it opens another, and then you do get two Safari windows.
Yeah,
but I don't want that to be the only way to open up two Safari windows. I actually want to have two web browsers that I can just type in the address, and you can at that point. I can type in the address. I can. Hit that touch bar or the address bar and type in another address. But I want to right click, quote unquote, you know, hard press, long press Safari and say open another window. And I can't do that right now.
I see. You want to open another like a desktop that you could swipe over, what do they call it? Spaces? That kind of thing?
That would be a good execution. Or I just want to be able to force open a second window that takes up the second half of the screen.
Yeah. That's tricky because you can only do tabs really easily.
You can only
like
really
that.
Do tabs easily.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want tabs. Exactly. I want to be able to pull a tab out and make that a second window.
Okay.
So I can see things side by
side. Can't
do
that?
Can't do that.
Hmm.
You can only do it through a link.
Okay.
By holding a link down, basically a preview.
Hmm.
Right. It uses that action where if you hold down a link, it opens up a preview of a web page.
Mm-hmm.
It opens that instance as a second window.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, so, now Apple knows how to make you happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're making a lot of people unhappy because on the MacBook side this week, there was also a big recall.
I don't know. It seems like people would be happy because
well,
they're probably, ostensibly, they didn't know that they had a ticking time bomb, and now they can return it and get an upgraded MacBook.
You think the recalling happened because people didn't know about it, or that they did know about it and complained, and that's why a recall happened?
I'm sure enough people knew about it, but it wasn't like
making
headlines.
Well, those people aren't
happy. Yeah, I suppose, right? They are probably.
So those people are getting are happy now because, yes, there was a 15-inch MacBook Pro battery recall. You can go to their website at support.apple and type in your serial number. It's basically Retina MacBook Pros 15-inch made by...
Between September 2015 and February 2017.
That's a big range. Well, over a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They called it a limited number of older generation 15-inch MacBooks.
But they will replace your battery.
Pros.
Which is good.
Yep.
There's a story on CNBC. This is super interesting, especially in the wave of the Oculus stuff we talked about last week and their store curation and the problems they have with they had with Virtual Desktop, mm-hmm. releasing updates that aren't reviewed. And one of the things we said is that, you know, this is a problem. One of the guidelines not being super clear initially, and some confusion over that on the consumer side and on the developer side. But also, Oculus just probably doesn't have in place the same type of app curation and app certification teams, the QAing process that a big walled garden like Apple or maybe even Google would have.
Yeah.
Well, we got a little bit of a closer look into what that QA process is like for the walled garden of the Apple App Store, because CNBC had a whole story about the group that does that. And it's a 400-person team.
I would imagine that this process and this group, this department, has evolved over the years.
And expanded dramatically.
Yes, but I imagine that there was a period where they were probably trying to automate things, because the influx of apps would have been like trying to review every YouTube video.
Yes, and there's some automation, right? They have software that when you submit an app will go through and run it through its paces, but this is for the pure editorializing side of it, and I'm sure some technical side. So it's 300 people, and they have an office in Sunnyvale, California, and I believe a international office as well or something. Basically, they have a pair of offices that in the Bay Area that house these people. A lot of people are multilingual, so they're fluent in non-English languages, so they can review those apps as well, which makes a lot of sense.
Worldwide, they review every app?
They review every update.
Oh my God. That's insane.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Compatibility is a big thing for like for iOS, new versions of iOS. That's a thing. And they said that 50% of the apps are reviewed within 24 to 48 hours.
Well, you can't let it get out of hand, or else you'll never finish.
Yeah, yeah. So there are definitely rushes, you know, when new versions of iOS happen. You know, unlike Facebook moderation teams, right? You know, they probably like them. They have to deal with some unsightly stuff sometimes, you know, things that they find in the apps. And in this report, they said that they have had to report apps to the FBI for things that are clearly illegal. But there's also an executive team, executive review board, and that goes over, you know, when the lower level reviews pass them, and when there's like appeals, then even Phil Schiller gets involved, and he takes a look and makes an executive decision about apps. So there's a whole hierarchy and a whole system in place, and it shows that there's the scale at which QA has to operate when you're running a walled garden. And even then, some of these decisions are just people determined, right? Even on the highest level, it is an executive making a decision, yes, this app is allowed, or no, it's not allowed. And as much as people want to complain about it, it is their platform, their walled garden, and they do have the final say.
Across the department, they speak 81 different languages.
Is that insane?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's an unfathomable number of apps in the App Store, and which makes this seem like an incredibly daunting task. I'm not saying it's not, but I'm sure the rate at which new apps are coming in is not like thousands by the day. Right, it's got to be manageable to an extent where 300 people
can
come at this point.
Well, they say reviewers have daily quotas of between 50 and 100 apps. And the number of apps that any individual reviewer gets through an hour is tracked by special software.
Wait, 50 to 100 per day?
Yeah.
If you're working, let's say, a 10-hour day, right? I think in the article, they don't work more than 12-hour days. That's still 5 apps an hour. 5 to 10 apps an hour. So an app every 6 minutes?
I don't know.
Or 12 minutes? Mm-hmm. That's not a long time.
No.
To go through an app.
Certainly not.
I'm sure they have code that like opens up every single possible window.
Yeah.
Like that an app can, from menus.
That'd be cool.
Right? Like they can get deep into the software.
Yeah.
Like it's part of the thing that makes their platform easy to program for probably can also get reverse engineered to make it easy to view every single possible asset, right? For an app.
Yep.
And not yeah. Yeah. I'm sure they're not like, they're not on iPhones swiping through playing Bejeweled to make sure they get to the end to approve the app.
Yeah. Wow. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Super fascinating. I'm surprised that story is out there and Apple allowed access. It wasn't like a big expose. They work with Apple PR. And I think that this is one of those things that they wanted to get out there in light of, you know, other walled gardens. We're going to talk about tablets. Going back, just one more story. Word came out. I don't know if this is an official news, but Google's essentially confirmed that they're out of the tablet game. The Pixel phones have done very well for them.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not as well as they had hoped for, but they've definitely kind of moved the market. But the Pixel Slate, which was released last year, running Chrome OS, the Chromebooks are still going to be a thing, but these tablets, no longer a thing. I think it's a smart move for Google. I think that there really was no upside to spending all this R&D on a marketplace that they were not getting a ton of traction.
I mean, is there any super successful Android tablet? I mean, it's basically the iPad.
They're still put it,
space, right?
It's basically the iPad. Yeah. So, I mean, Samsung has tablets, LG has tablets, and, you know, and convertibles are a thing. But I think Chromebooks are where their big success
is. Yeah, but now look at iPad OS. They're trying to be more Chromebooky all the time.
But the cost, big cost difference.
Yeah.
Right. Big cost difference. You can get Chromebook real, real cheap. I kind of hope they would be doing this also with Android Wear, because Android Wear also, their watch stuff, also not making a lot of traction. There are a lot of businesses that Google feels like has to be in because everyone else is in there and they have the money to do that. And they got in also early. But like at least on the Android Wear side, I've been trying this new Android Wear watch and it's slow. I think they're limited because they don't make end-to-end the hardware and the software.
They're
at the behest of their hardware partners.
Did you see the article from Bill Gates where he said his one big regret is ceding the phone challenger to Google, the iPhone challenger to
right.
Google?
This is complete. Like the understanding is that they're Apple aside, they were never going to dominate like Apple. His regret wasn't not beating Apple. His regret was not making Android.
Right.
They were late, and you know what? That's squarely on Ballmer. It's squarely on that Nokia acquisition.
Yeah. Okay.
Like Windows Mobile had its place, but they were slow to pivot, and Ballmer was you know at the helm throughout all of that, and that was kind of 10 years of failure after failure.
Well, Bill Gates didn't blame Ballmer, at least in this article. He seemed to take whatever responsibility. He didn't nail down any certain decision that he made. He said it's whatever mismanagement he allowed.
Wow. That's some management shade.
Right.
Right? Like, as executive, I will take the sword, but because I allowed idiots under me to make poor purchasing decisions and executive decisions, it's regretful.
Yeah.
But the culmination of that, and Microsoft has had so much turnover, people running Windows, Terry Myerson, and even Jay Allard way back then, and Steven Sinofsky, right? All the people have shepherded their products to release and kind of left. The result of that, though, is a pretty stable Microsoft ecosystem, Windows ecosystem, a stable Office business, a stable cloud business, a very profitable cloud business, and Microsoft being... You know, they can. I think Bill Gates can say that now because his stock is worth more than ever,
and pretty decent hardware,
and good hardware. Yeah, on the Surface team. Yeah, yeah. But Panos Panay's team has done really well. And speaking of that, the big rumor is, or the big question is, what is Surface going to do next? Right, Panos is now in charge of all their hardware devices, and the big rumor is Intel's a big push for dual screen tablets. And even we saw Lenovo with their OLED foldable screen, dual screen tablets. Microsoft is rumored to put out their low power version of Windows, Windows Lite OS.
Okay.
And so Microsoft may have a Surface device for that could also be a dual screen device.
Foldable screen?
I don't think I think dual screen and foldable screens are going to be conflated. I think they're going to run the same OS. The OS is made for dual screens. Mm-hmm. But I think what it sounds like is Microsoft is going to have a version that will actually have two discrete screens.
Okay.
That maybe come together or don't come together. But you can run as a tablet, as a book, as a laptop with a digital keyboard, like that kind of thing.
So wait, the Windows low power is not going to be full-fledged Windows OS?
I don't know exactly what the difference will be, but it will not be full-fledged Windows OS. It'll cost cheaper for licensors.
Got it.
But the new Surface, as people in supply chain have rumored to report, is that it's two 9-inch screens. And thankfully, the thing I'm most excited for, the thing I saw with the Lenovo foldable screen system, whatever they want to call it, because they don't have a name yet, is a 4:3 aspect ratio, which I'm very excited for. But yeah, Intel has, you know, it's crying around Intel. Intel has their 10-nanometer low-power chips coming out later this year. And so with Lite OS, there's a lot of opportunity for OEMs to make really light, really interesting kind of in between. It's basically new netbooks, right? In between tablets and in between laptops. You know, it is the new convertible.
Okay.
A new market for convertibles. Something that Microsoft will have to contend with, and a lot of other companies will have to contend with, consoles. I'm going to jump through the rest of the news pretty quickly because I know we have to end this podcast in about, 10 minutes. Nintendo, Microsoft, and Sony came out with a joint letter saying that U.S. consumers will have to pay more in a total of $840 million for next-generation consoles and this-generation consoles if Chinese tariffs continue.
Oh, wow.
So they wrote this letter. Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo wrote the letter to Trump administration saying that looming tariffs on these goods will harm the video game industry and its employees. A 20% tariff hike will basically cost consumers up towards of $1 billion. So
I don't know.
That sucks.
I know Trump watches a lot of TV, but I've never read a thing about him being a big gamer.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to move. I don't think he's going to care much about this. This is more so voters will care. Hey, there's an election next year. Back on the Microsoft news, at E3, they announced Microsoft Flight Simulator. Now, I put out a request last week for people to chime in as Flight Simulator fans to chime in on their opinions, how this affects their, you know, them and what their concerns are, because there is a dedicated fan base for Microsoft Flight Simulator. And some of the things that they said were mods. Number one consideration is mods. What could be going on? Mm-hmm. Whether it's going to support it. And so Microsoft has come out. The Flight Simulator team has come out and said, one, they will allow mods. They acknowledge that mods are a huge part of the Flight Simulator experience. It's going to be PC first. And it will, of course, support as many peripherals as possible. So it doesn't really go into like the platform side of it all, and you know the Microsoft Pass and the distribution method and what software you'll need to run this. They said accessibility and community is a huge part, and PC first is a big part of Flight Simulator, and of course they emphasize simulator for this. So
it's a great quote from Leonardo da Vinci on this: "For once you have tasted flight, you will walk the earth with your eyes turned skywards. For there you have been. And there you will long to return."
Well, for a man who never flew,
yeah,
and only dreamed
but
of it.
But dreamed of it.
He's absolutely. What would he think today of screaming babies and disappointed Wi-Fi users on domestic flights, taking it for granted?
Exactly.
Yeah. Last bits of tech news. DisplayPort 2.0 spec has been announced. Support by late 2020 and 8K video support.
Okay.
For that. So that's the next-gen DisplayPort interface. More to come as we find more details about that.
Does HDMI not support 8K?
Depends on what frame rate.
Oh, okay.
And what hurts. Last bits. We're not going to have a full moment of science because Kishore's it here, but two things I want to call out. One is that the solar sail that Planetary Society had been working on, this is called Sagan's Big Dream, it may take flight soon.
Okay. Great.
And as a payload to what was what launched, which was the SpaceX Falcon Heavy. Did you watch that launch?
Yeah. Wait, this launched from this most recent SpaceX?
Well, it was part of the payload.
Yeah.
I don't know if it has deployed yet. I haven't done the follow-up.
That's cool.
But did you watch the launch?
Uh-huh.
And?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I hate to say it's routine now. I was sad to see the center core didn't quite make it.
I mean, is it not still science fiction when you see the boosters?
Oh, my God. It's totally science fiction.
It's super science fiction.
I love it. It's like watching a video in reverse. It's awesome.
I had my hand over my mouth, just like in anticipation.
Yeah.
And when it landed, the boosters, amazing. And when the core exploded, they rolled with it pretty well.
Yeah.
The on-screen presenters in the live stream.
It's happened before.
That's it for technology news. Before we jump into our last segment, which will be the VR Minute, I want to thank the other sponsor that makes this podcast possible, and that is Mouser. Do you ever wonder why your cat seems to be bored of its toys so fast? Cats are natural-born predators that want to hunt, but today's automatic toys just move around randomly. But real prey isn't random. Real prey reacts. That's why the guys at Petronix invented the Mouser, a fully autonomous robotic mouse for your cat. As PhD students in the electrical engineering department of the University of Illinois, they knew that Mouser had to be a real robot to actually be interesting for cats. So Mouser comes with a complete suite of sensors and onboard intelligence so it can sense and react to your cat and its environment. Did you ever think your cat would have a robot friend before you? Well, right now, tested cat owners like you can save 20% when you visit petronix.io/test and use the code TEST at checkout. Again, that's Petronix, PETRONICS.io/test, and use the checkout code TEST to save 20% because you and your cat need more robots in your lives. It sounds like Black Mirror stuff, but it's real.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
All right, it's got to be like close to a minute here because
if you own a Quest and you play Rec Room, the new Quest is available. What's it called?
Jumbotron.
I was saying Robotron, but yeah, it's Jumbotron, the sci-fi themed Quest, probably my second favorite after the pirate one.
Yeah,
is available now, and you should go play it.
That's your Quest news. HTC had more specs from the HTC Cosmos. This is their standalone VR headset. They made a big deal out of talking about the resolution. It is an RGB panel, 2800 by 1700 combined resolution, which is a big increase, of course, over the original Vive. It's going to be 90 FPS, and the Cosmos is the headset that's going to do some weird streaming stuff from the PC.
Why are they making a big deal out of 90 FPS? It's the same thing as the Vive.
But this is their Quest competitor.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's why. That makes sense. High resolution,
also higher frame rate. And they're talking about reduced screen door effect because of their full RGB panels, increased subpixels, improved clarity. We got to try this. You know, they have the removable faceplate, the inside-out tracking, 6 cameras, all that stuff. I think last time we tried some HTC inside-out technology, when you tried some at the at E3 mm-hmm. or at GDC, yep. you were not as impressed
with the
Vive Focus.
Ah, sorry. You're right, Focus. So many Vives.
I know. And the big thing with HTC, of course, is regardless of the hardware they put out, it's really going to be the software ecosystem and what you're going to be able to play. And so the PC tethering, that type of PC streaming, whatever they can do for that, that will probably the make or break for this, because it's not going to be as cheap as the Quest. It's going to be an expensive headset. Big news for launch on the PC side. Index launches this week. Some people received theirs.
They did?
Yeah. Oh. People, shipping notifications went out earlier this week. Congratulations to all of you that have received your Vive Index, or your Valve Index. Sorry, I don't want to, it's very easy to misspeak there.
Yep.
The Valve Index, it's out. I'm glad it's out. The robot Aperture Hand Lab is now out on Steam. If you have,
does that work on standard Vive, or do you need an Index for it?
Don't know.
Okay.
Good question. I don't see how you could do it on the standard Vive.
Yeah. I wonder if it would run, just so people can see it and like get a feel for the flavor.
If you're playing Portal. That, my recommendation is just to let the robots talk for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. Just like, if you think they're done, they're not done.
Let them go.
Flip them off. Do some all sorts of obscene gestures toward them. And that ties into the thing that I really want to point out. The hand presence and the finger tracking in the Index and in Aperture Hand Lab are great, but it's really the character design. It's the character interaction. Them recognizing the gestures and the scripting that went into there. I've been playing Trover Saves the Universe, Justin Roiland game, and it reinforces for me what's going to the killer thing in single-player VR is NPC design. Is character animation, is dialogue. It's the same with Lone Echo, but I think even stronger than Lone Echo. I think the best characters I've seen, even though they're like low fidelity, they're just like blobs color and like cartoons. In Trover Saves the Universe, they're the best VR NPCs I've ever experienced.
Well, they're well scripted and well voice acted
and animated.
Nah, there's not a whole lot of animation going on.
They look fantastic.
Do you think that game requires VR?
I think, well, one, yes, because you nod and shake your head.
That's true.
At the characters.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's, to your point, it is a fun game for people to watch on a flat screen. And it plays on a flat screen. No, the answer is no, it doesn't need VR because they also have a flat screen version of that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, you can play it without VR. But I think VR, it, looking at you, you controlling Trover, and it, the eyes tracking the other characters as they talk to each other,
yeah,
all that subtleness all really enhances the sense of presence.
It's super funny. Very well scripted.
It's on Steam Store, and you know it's a great game to play on the Index if you have that.
Defector release date is July 11th. It's announced it's like a Jason Bourne title. You've seen us covered on Projections.
$20.
$20.
$20.
That's pretty good.
Which, to me, is kind of worrisome, because when we first saw it over a year ago, the developers, these are the folks at Twisted Pixel, they were saying how this was their Fast and Furious, Jason Bourne, like spy game, big budget game. And yeah, a lot of the action sequences seem big budget, but I wonder if they scaled back.
I don't know.
I wonder if it's the ambitions were a little more limited. They either cut content or shorten sequences or tighten things up.
You want to know how long the game is.
Yeah. Or how many, I wonder whether this was as big a launch as they anticipated, or if they're not as confident in it anymore. Why? Because I can't imagine like an Asgard's Wrath coming out being $20.
Right, no.
Maybe. Or Stormlands.
Yeah. So I don't know, we'll see. I mean, at $20, maybe they're just thinking, let's sell a bunch of these. Let's see if we can make up in quantity, what, you know, instead of an...
it doesn't feel like it's that affordable because Oculus subsidized it in the same way that Global Recall was free. So it worries me just a little bit, but I want to reserve judgment until we get a chance to play the full game.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I think that covers basically everything that we wanted to cover. There's a Fortune has an interesting story about, you know, they call it the rise and fall, the fall and rise of VR. Basically, it's about the struggle for VR companies to make money, and long short of it's a okay long read. It's basically a promo piece for the Quest, talking about, you know, this is their Facebook's big bet into VR right now, but really talking to companies that really were early in VR, like John, and where they've pivoted, and a lot of now enterprise solutions and LBE being where VR is these days. So if you're interested in the money side of VR and how much money has been put into investment in VR and AR, it's a business story. That's why I said Fortune. You can Google that. It's online. That does it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for sticking around. I know you have the jet.
You're welcome.
Hopefully we'll have Kishore back next week. I know you won't be here next
week. That's correct.
It is July 4th weekend. But thank you all out there for listening. Hey, let us know what you thought about Toy Story 4. If you got a Valve Index, let us know what you think of that as well. And before we end, I'm going to go refresh my search for Bitcoin price. Let's see. Current price, it's stabilized at $11,700. So
very exciting.
$2,000 price drop.
Justin, aka Speed, brings us yet another outro, although it might be an old outro. Let's see.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
Yeah, I guess there are other movies to tell James, like Avatar 2 and 3 and 4 and Aliens and Alien, whatever other Alien movies he made.
Bye.
Bye.